Lincoln, Disc 25.
While Lincoln was trying to establish his control over the Army of the Potomac, he also sought to give a new direction to public opinion. Up to this point, he'd largely accepted the traditional view that the president, once elected, had no direct dealings with the public. His job was to administer the government and to report his actions and wishes to the Congress. Presidents rarely left the capital city, except for brief vacations. They almost never made public addresses, and they maintained, in theory, a sublime indifference to public opinion and political pressures. Like many other self-made men, Lincoln was very conventional and hesitated to break this tradition. It never occurred to him to go in person before Congress and read his eloquent messages, for that was something that hadn't been done since Jefferson's day. Though occasionally he would say a few words at a Union rally in Washington, he knew that he was not good at extemporaneous speaking and rarely made any public appearances outside the White House. His one innovation had been to maintain an open house at the Executive Mansion, during which as many of the curious and the complainers, the office-seekers and favor-hunters as wanted to wait in line, had an opportunity to speak with the president. Though that kind of openness certainly didn't injure him in public esteem, it did little to get his message across to the people. And by midsummer of 1863, it was desperately important that the administration's policies should be understood. On no issue was this need so great as on the abrogation of civil liberties. Curtailment of the freedom of speech and of the press, arrests of dissenters and the disloyal, always called arbitrary arrests by his opponents, and above all, suspension of the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus deeply troubled many Americans. Of course, the peace Democrats vigorously protested against these measures, and after the arrest and trial of Vallandigham, many of the war Democrats joined them. But they were not alone. Within the president's own party, a conservative like his friend Browning believed that the arrests ordered by the Lincoln administration were illegal and arbitrary, and did more harm than good, weakening instead of strengthening the government. The radical, Lyman Trumbull, agreed that all arbitrary arrests of citizens by military authority are unwarrantable and are doing much injury, and that if they continue unchecked, the civil tribunals will be completely subordinated to the military, and the government overthrown. Even in the president's own cabinet, Gideon Welles lamented that our military officers should, without absolute necessity, disregard those great principles on which our government and institutions rest. Most dangerous of all was the growing sentiment in the army that, as one Massachusetts soldier wrote his family, the president, without the people having any legal means to prevent it, is only prevented from exercising a Russian despotism by the fear he may have of shocking too much the sense of decency of the whole world. Aware of the widespread public unhappiness, Lincoln grew restive at remaining a prisoner of the White House. For a time, he considered attending a huge July 4th celebration planned for Philadelphia, where he could, for the first time since his inauguration, have a chance to speak directly to the public. But Lee's impending invasion of Pennsylvania put an end to that idea. The favorable reception of his public letters to friends of the Union cause in Manchester and London suggested another way he could explain to the people why he'd found it necessary to suspend the writ of habeas corpus. As ideas came to him that seemed to have force and make perfect answer to some of the things that were said and written about his actions, he jotted them down on scraps of paper and put them in a drawer. When the appropriate time came, he could put together these disconnected thoughts in a public letter. The protest of a group of New York Democrats against the arrest of Vallandigham gave him the opportunity for which he'd been waiting. Headed by Erastus Corning, president of the New York Central Railroad, the meeting adopted resolutions strongly condemning the arrest and trial of Vallandigham as a blow against the spirit of our laws and Constitution, and an abrogation of the liberty of speech and of the press, the right of trial by jury, the law of evidence, and the privilege of habeas corpus. If sustained by the president, the arrest and banishment would strike a fatal blow at the supremacy of law and the authority of the state and federal constitutions. When a copy of the resolutions reached Lincoln, he realized that his enemies had been delivered into his hands. The signers of the Albany protest were not, apart from Corning himself, persons of much political influence, nor were they supporters of the Union cause whose loyalty was being tested by the Vallandigham case. Instead, they were obscure local Democratic politicians who made their partisanship clear by including a gratuitous complimentary reference to Governor Horatio Seymour in the resolutions. The whole affair, as one White House intimate judged, had the stinking aroma of party politics, and the protesters, with no defined idea of molding the present state of things into a sane unity, wanted either to run the machine independently of the president or to bully him into their notions. Drawing on the notes he'd collected in his drawer, Lincoln took exceptional care in preparing his response. Although he said he put that paper together in less time than any other of like importance ever prepared by me, because he'd already given too much thought to the subject. On June 5th, he took the unusual precaution of reading his proposed response to the members of the cabinet, and Gideon Wells noted, "It has vigor and ability, and with some corrections will be a strong paper." By June 12th, he'd revised and polished his letter, and he sent it off to Corning that day, with a copy to the influential New York Tribune. Lincoln's public letter began disarmingly with praise for the Albany protesters' eminently patriotic statement that they favored sustaining the Union and would uphold the administration in all constitutional measures. That left the question whether the military arrests and subsequent trials, for which the president was ultimately responsible, were constitutional. Willingly, Lincoln conceded that in normal times these would be violations of constitutionally guaranteed rights. But he pointed out that the Constitution itself provided for the suspension of these liberties in cases of rebellion or invasion when the public safety may require it. Clearly, the United States now faced a rebellion, clear, flagrant, and gigantic, so that public safety did require suspension of the writ of habeas corpus. Thoroughly imbued with a reverence for the guaranteed rights of individuals, Lincoln explained that he'd been slow to adopt the strong measures of his administration, and he predicted that the time was not unlikely to come when I shall be blamed for having made too few arrests rather than too many. Turning directly to the protesters' objection that Vallandigham had been arrested far from any insurrection and outside any military lines, Lincoln bluntly replied that the suspension of civil liberties was constitutional wherever the public safety does require them. Vallandigham, he pointed out, was not jailed because he was a political opponent of the administration or of the commanding general, Burnside, but because he was damaging the army, upon the existence and vigor of which the life of the nation depends. Then, in his most effective paragraph, the president noted that even his Albany petitioners had to recognize his right and duty to sustain the armies by punishing desertion, even with the death penalty. "Must I shoot a simple-minded soldier boy who deserts?" he asked, "while I must not touch a hair of a wily agitator who induces him to desert?" Finally, Lincoln rejected the argument that the precedent set by military arrests during the rebellion would be followed in the peaceful post-war future. This argument, he suggested, was like saying that a man could contract so strong an appetite for emetics during temporary illness as to persist in feeding upon them through the remainder of his healthful life. Lincoln considered his letter to Corning the best state paper he'd written up to that time, and public response confirmed his feeling. If it did nothing to convince the disloyal or the more extreme among the peace Democrats, it reassured Unionists genuinely troubled by an assumption of despotic power on the part of the president. Lincoln's low-key announcement that he regretted the arrest of Vallandigham, or, as he carefully phrased it, that he was pained that there should have seemed to be a necessity for arresting him, and his promise to discharge the congressman so soon as the public safety will not suffer by it, undercut charges of presidential tyranny and gave credence to his statement to a White House visitor that he was more of a chief clerk than a despot. If Lincoln's letter was, perhaps by intention, not an overwhelming technical defense of the constitutionality of his actions, it was a clear demonstration of their necessity. Its lasting impact could be measured by the fact that henceforth Clement L. Vallandigham would always be stigmatized as a wily agitator. Proud of his letter, Lincoln had copies printed and sent out under Nicolays Frank to leading Republicans. Their response was enthusiastic. "The right word has at last been spoken by the right man at the right time and from the right place," rejoiced John W. Forney of the Washington Chronicle. "It will thrill the whole land. It was one of your best state papers," judged former Governor E.D. Morgan. And another New Yorker considered it of more value to the cause we all have at heart than a victory. Praising the letter as felicitous and timely, Roscoe Conkling, defeated in the recent congressional contest, recognized the value of the document in the upcoming New York elections, where he thought it made the best campaign document we can have in this state. Published in the New York Tribune, reissued as a pamphlet, and given further distribution as a publication of the Loyal Publication Society, at least 500,000 copies of the Corning letter were read by 10 million people. So successful was Lincoln's first attempt to reach out directly to the people that he lost no time in following it with a second public letter, this time addressed to Matthew Burchard and other delegates to the Ohio State Democratic Convention who came to the White House in order to protest Vallandigham's arrest, trial, and banishment. Ohio Governor David Toad wanted Lincoln to treat these visitors with the contempt they richly merit. Secretary Chase, who understood the intricacies of Ohio politics, urged him to respond to the delegation in writing. Aware that the Ohio Democrats had just chosen Vallandigham as their gubernatorial candidate, even though he was a convicted lawbreaker now in exile, Lincoln issued a hard-hitting statement. Vallandigham, he bluntly asserted, was responsible personally in a greater degree than any other one man for the desertions from the army, the resistance to the draft, and even the assassination of Unionists. By endorsing him, the Ohio delegation was itself encouraging desertion, resistance to the draft, and the like. He concluded by promising to allow Vallandigham to return to the country, providing that each member of the delegation would sign a pledge to do all he can to have the officers, soldiers, and seamen of the Army and Navy paid, fed, clad, and otherwise well provided and supported. The refusal of the Ohio Democrats to accept his offer, considering it a sacrifice of their dignity and self-respect, simply confirmed Lincoln's message to the people that his administration was exercising exceptional powers only in the interest of self-preservation. Self-preservation also dictated a change in the command of the Army of the Potomac. As Lee moved across the Potomac, Hooker closely followed, offering an effective screen for Washington and Baltimore and keeping his troops in readiness for a major combat on the northern soil. But as usual, he resisted accepting suggestions or orders. Lincoln, who saw in the Confederate invasion the best opportunity we've had since the war began, wanted to maintain a sizable garrison at Harper's Ferry, where, to the left and the rear of the Confederate advance, it might compel Lee to divide his forces, as he'd been obliged to do in the Antietam campaign. Then Hooker could deliver the devastating defeat to the Army of Northern Virginia that McClellan had failed to inflict in September 1862. But Hooker believed in the military doctrine of concentration of force and insisted that Harper's Ferry be abandoned. When Halleck ordered him to sustain that garrison, Hooker resigned, assuming, no doubt, that on the eve of a major battle, his resignation would be rejected. It was not. Ignoring the widespread outcry for the recall of McClellan, Lincoln, on June 28th, replaced Hooker with George Gordon Meade, one of the most experienced corps commanders of the Army of the Potomac, who'd been in every major engagement since the first Battle of Bull Run. Tall, thin, and bespectacled, Meade was not a charismatic leader. He looked, a Massachusetts soldier reported, like a good sort of a family doctor. But he was well organized and highly professional, and he had the respect, if not necessarily the affection, of his men. As Meade took command and followed Lee into Pennsylvania, Lincoln showed how much he'd learned from his dealings with Hooker. To this new commander went no fatherly notes of admonition, no folksy advice about strategy. Indeed, he wrote to Meade not at all, but made his wishes known only through Halleck. The president devoted his energies to raising new troops to reinforce Meade's army in order to protect the crossings of the Susquehanna River and other routes that led to Philadelphia, and to calming the excited officials of Pennsylvania and New Jersey, who feared their states were in the way of the Confederate advance. Lincoln's attention was not focused solely on the Army of the Potomac, for he kept a close eye on Grant's campaign against Vicksburg. The president had never tried to direct Grant's strategy. The distances were too great for the army on the Mississippi to be managed from Washington. But he thought that Grant should bypass Vicksburg, go south, and join forces with N.P. Banks, who was advancing up the Mississippi River from Louisiana. Instead, Grant plunged into the interior of Mississippi, defeated Confederate forces in a series of engagements, and pushed John C. Pemberton's army back into Vicksburg. During much of this campaign, Grant told no one of his plans and seemed simply to have disappeared. Failing to reach him by letter or telegram, Lincoln desperately sought for news of his army from reports in the Confederate newspapers. "Do the Richmond papers have anything about Vicksburg?" he wired General John A. Dix at Fort Monroe. "Have you anything from Grant?" he telegraphed to General Rosecrans at Murfreesboro. As the news slowly filtered in, he began to get a better idea of Grant's campaign. And by the time the Union Army put the Confederates under siege in Vicksburg, he could understand both the boldness and the skill of his general. "Whether General Grant shall or shall not consummate the capture of Vicksburg," he wrote a complainer on May 26th, "his campaign from the beginning of this month up to the 22nd day of it is one of the most brilliant in the world." Even so, as the siege of Vicksburg stretched on through June, he worried constantly about Grant and his army. Carefully, he scrutinized Confederate newspapers, which carried reports, all erroneous, that Sherman had been seriously wounded during the siege, that Banks had lost an arm in his campaign for Port Hudson, that Confederate General Edmund Kirby Smith was bringing reinforcements from the Trans-Mississippi region to relieve Vicksburg. Because there was always the danger that the Confederates might draw troops from another arena to assist Pemberton, Lincoln vainly urged Rosecrans in Tennessee to do his utmost, short of rashness, to keep Bragg from getting off to help Joseph E. Johnston against Grant. Under the enormous strain of worry about two armies poised for decisive battle, the president's health began to suffer. He had a nightmare about Tad, who'd accompanied his mother on a shopping trip to Philadelphia. His ugly dream featured the pistol he'd permitted the boy to have, big enough to snap caps but no cartridges or powder. And he wired Mary, "Think you better put Tad's pistol away." A visitor found the president's face told a story of anxiety and weariness, noting the drooping eyelids looking almost swollen, the dark bags beneath the eyes, the deep marks about the large and expressive mouth. Then, on July 4th, finally came the news that Lincoln had so long awaited. Staying close to the telegraph office in the War Department, he learned of a great and bloody battle that had been fought during the three previous days at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Though details were lacking, it appeared that Lee had been defeated and was retreating. Jubilantly, the president issued a press release from the War Department announcing this great success to the cause of the Union, and urging that on this day, he whose will, not ours, should ever be done, be everywhere remembered and reverenced with profoundest gratitude. 3 days later, Secretary Welles received a dispatch from Admiral David Dixon Porter announcing the fall of Vicksburg, and rushed to the White House with the news. His face beaming with joy, Lincoln caught Welles's hand and, throwing his arm around him, exclaimed, "What can we do for the Secretary of the Navy, for this glorious intelligence? I cannot, in words, tell you my joy over this result. It's great, Mr. Welles, it's great." For a few days in early July, it seemed that the end of the war was at hand. With the fall of Vicksburg, where Pemberton surrendered his army of 30,000, and Port Hudson, July 8th, the Mississippi from Cairo to New Orleans was once more in Union hands. The fleet, now under Admiral Dahlgren, who succeeded Admiral DuPont on July 6th, was slowly battering Charleston to rubble. And in the east, Meade had to fight just one more battle to destroy Lee's army, which was trapped between the advancing Army of the Potomac and the Potomac River, swollen with summer rains. But Meade didn't advance swiftly, and, after a council of war with his senior generals, postponed an attack. Lee escaped into Virginia. Never was Lincoln so disappointed and so furious. "If I'd gone up there, I could have whipped them myself," he exclaimed. "Our army held the war in the hollow of their hand, and they wouldn't close it," he fumed. He took special offense at a dispatch of Meade's praising his army for driving the invader from our soil. "The whole country is our soil," he insisted. And he feared that Meade's purpose was not to defeat Lee, but to get the enemy across the river again without further collision. His anger didn't fade quickly. Weeks later, he expressed deep mortification that Lee's army hadn't been destroyed. "Meade and his army had expended their skill and toil and blood up to the ripe harvest," he grieved, "and then allowed it to go to waste." From the depths of his unhappiness, he wrote a bitter letter to Meade, expressing gratitude for his magnificent success at Gettysburg, but lamenting, "My dear General, I don't believe you appreciate the magnitude of the misfortune involved in Lee's escape. He was within your easy grasp, and to have closed upon him would, in connection with our other late successes, have ended the war. As it is, the war will be prolonged indefinitely. Your golden opportunity is gone, and I am distressed immeasurably because of it." Then, characteristically, he didn't sign or send the letter. As he cooled down, he came to recognize that he was expecting too much of Meade. At the time the Battle of Gettysburg began, Meade had been in command of the Army of the Potomac for only 4 days, and he was working with new and untried subordinates. His army had suffered enormous losses during the 3 days of battle, and some of its ablest and most aggressive generals were dead or wounded. Meade himself was exhausted. As he wrote his wife on July 8th, "Now, over 10 days, I haven't changed my clothes, haven't had a regular night's rest, and many nights not a wink of sleep, and for several days didn't even wash my face and hands, no regular food, and all the time in a great state of mental anxiety." It was asking too much of him to attack Robert E. Lee. Lincoln withheld his letter, though he permitted Halleck to wire that the escape of Lee's army had created great dissatisfaction in the mind of the president. Meade promptly submitted his resignation, and Halleck was forced to backtrack, saying that his telegram wasn't intended as a censure, but as a stimulus to an active pursuit. By this time, Lincoln had recovered his equanimity and could speak of Meade as a brave and skillful officer and a true man, who was responsible for the success at Gettysburg. Indeed, the president's spirits were so high that he composed a doggerel, General Lee's Invasion of the North, written by himself, which he gave to John Hay. In 1863, with pomp and mighty swell, me and Jeff's Confederacy went forth to sack Fidel. The Yankees, they got arter us and give us particular hell, and we skedaddled back again and didn't sack Fidel. In the next few weeks, Lincoln had need of his good humor. On July 2nd, Mary Lincoln, who'd come back from Philadelphia, had a carriage accident while returning alone to the White House from the presidential cottage at the Soldiers' Home, an elevated spot 3 miles from the Capitol, where the Lincolns sought relief from the oppressive Washington heat. Someone, probably in the hope of injuring the president, had unscrewed the bolts to the driver's seat in her carriage, and when it became detached, the horses grew frightened and ran away. Mary was thrown out and hit her head on a sharp rock. Initially, it seemed that she'd only received severe bruises, and the president telegraphed Robert, "Don't be uneasy. Your mother very slightly hurt by her fall." But the wound became infected, and for 3 weeks she required round-the-clock nursing. After this accident, Mary's headaches, of which she'd long complained, became more frequent, and Robert thought she never fully recovered from her fall. Lincoln couldn't spend much time at his wife's bedside because on July 13th, draft riots erupted in New York City. Attempts to enforce the Conscription Act led to resistance in many parts of the country. In Holmes County, Ohio, Rush and Sullivan counties in Indiana, in Milwaukee, in the mining districts of Pennsylvania, and elsewhere. But only in New York was there a full-scale insurrection. For 3 days, working-class mobs, consisting mostly of Irish Americans, roamed the streets looting and burning. More than 100 people were killed before Union troops, fresh from the Battle of Gettysburg, arrived to preserve order. Briefed by reports filtered to him by Sidney Howard Gay, the managing editor of the New York Tribune, the president anxiously followed these events. The news from New York, which coincided with reports that Lee's army had escaped unscathed across the Potomac, deeply depressed him. At one cabinet meeting, he told his colleagues that he didn't believe we could take up anything in cabinet today. Probably none of us were in a right frame of mind for deliberation. He was not. But it wasn't clear what he could do to help quell the rioting, especially since Governor Seymour didn't ask for federal assistance. When the violence in New York died down, there was pressure on the president to appoint a special commissioner to investigate the causes of the riots. But Lincoln, after toying with the notion, turned it down. If the commissioner made a thorough investigation, he said, his report would have simply touched a match to a barrel of gunpowder. It was best to shy away from the issue. One rebellion at a time is about as much as we can conveniently handle. The rest of the summer was a relatively tranquil time for the president. Military affairs were under control, with capable professionals like Meade and Grant in command of the armies. The Congress had adjourned, and the president wasn't constantly badgered by demands from Capitol Hill. During the exceptionally hot weather, Lincoln stayed mostly at the soldiers' home. He was often alone because Mary, after recovering from her accident, went with Robert and Tad to the White Mountains of New Hampshire. Some of the time the president was lonely, but he kept in touch with his traveling family by letters and telegrams. One carried sad news for Tad about the fate of his little goat, Nanny, who caused such destruction in the gardens at the soldiers' home that she had to be brought back to the White House. There she was presently discovered, resting herself and chewing her little cud on the middle of Tad's bed. Then she disappeared, and the president wrote his family, "This is the last we know of poor Nanny." During this quiet period, Lincoln had time to assess his administration, and on the whole, he was pleased with what he'd been able to accomplish. Now that he'd roused himself from the torpor into which repeated military and political reverses had cast him, he once more felt himself a leader with a loyal constituency. Increasingly self-confident, he relied less and less on the advice of his cabinet officers. In their separate spheres, he recognized their expertise and let them have their own way. When Secretary Chase came to him with a set of complicated regulations for trading with the South, the president promptly signed them, saying, "You understand these things, I do not." But the cabinet as a whole, he consulted only sporadically and unsystematically. Nearly every cabinet member complained. "There is, in fact, no cabinet," grumbled Bates, "and the show of cabinet councils is getting more and more a mere show. Little matters or isolated propositions are sometimes talked over, but the great business of the country, questions of leading policy, aren't mentioned." Even the loyal Gideon Wells had to confess that there was no consultation about major issues like slavery and the restoration of the southern states to the Union. "Of the policy of the administration, if there be one," he told a correspondent, "I'm not advised beyond what's published and known to all." Lincoln was not being intentionally rude to his advisers. Sharing the general impression that we near the end of the war, he simply didn't think that they could offer any useful ideas on how to eradicate slavery and bring the southern states back into the Union. These problems the president alone could solve. He didn't shrink from the responsibility, and now that he'd asserted himself as a popular leader, he rather enjoyed his role as leader of opinion. "The tycoon is in fine whack," John Hay reported in August. "I've rarely seen him more serene and busy. He's managing this war, the draft, foreign relations, and planning a reconstruction of the Union all at once. I never knew with what tyrannous authority he rules the cabinet, till now. The most important things he decides, and there's no cavil." He brought this sense of serenity and power to a controversy that Governor Seymour opened after the New York City draft riots. Seymour, whom critics had accused of coddling the rioters, tried to persuade the president to suspend the draft in New York, on the grounds, first, that conscription was unconstitutional, and, second, that the quotas allotted to his state were glaringly unjust. In a series of letters, the governor detailed his objections and his protests against the draft quotas. In what Hay called a sockdolager of a reply, which was widely published in the newspapers, Lincoln showed none of the hesitancy that had paralyzed him for the past 6 months. "If discrimination against New York could be shown," he wrote Seymour, "he was willing to make concessions, so far as consistent with practical convenience, but he was not prepared to hold up the draft until Seymour could procure a United States Supreme Court ruling on its constitutionality. The Confederacy, he pointed out, was forcing every able-bodied man into their army, very much as a butcher drives bullocks into a slaughter pen. And the Union couldn't spare the time either for another experiment with the failed volunteer system or for a test in the courts. The correspondence between the New York governor and the president sputtered on for several weeks, Seymour insisting that there's no theory which can explain or justify the enrollments, that is, the draft quotas, in this state. And Lincoln persisting, "My purpose is to be just and fair, and yet to not lose time." Eventually, the president felt forced to prepare an order calling the New York State militia into federal service for the purpose of enforcing the draft. But Seymour yielded just in time, and the draft began without much incident on August 19th. In the showdown, the governor, not the president, blinked. At about the time of this controversy, Lincoln, remembering the success of his letters to Corning and to Burchard about the Vallandigham affair, began drafting another public paper that would explain the draft and defend its constitutionality. "I address you without searching for a precedent upon which to do so," he began, noting that it was especially important to avoid misunderstanding between the public and the public servant. To opponents who claimed the draft was unconstitutional, he pointed out that the Constitution explicitly gives Congress the power to raise and support armies. The Conscription Act was thus a law made in literal pursuance of this part of the United States Constitution. Nor was there doubt about the expediency of the draft. Only by raising additional armies could the Republican institutions and territorial integrity of our country be maintained, he continued. There can be no army without men. Since voluntary recruiting had ceased, the draft was necessary. But when it came to defending specific provisions of the Conscription Act, which exempted a man from the draft if he provided a substitute or paid a commutation fee of $300, Lincoln's language became murky and his reasoning tortured. Confusingly, he termed the commutation clause a boon to poor men, because without it the price of substitutes might skyrocket, thus leaving the man who could raise only $300 no escape from personal service. He also had trouble defending the draft quotas allocated to states and districts, arguing that absolute equality was unattainable, and adding, somewhat feebly, that errors will occur in spite of the utmost fidelity. It wasn't a satisfactory document, and probably because he realized he was trying to defend the indefensible, Lincoln shelved it. If he was going to reach out directly to the people, he needed a stronger case. No letter, public or private, could help Lincoln resolve the tangle of problems in Missouri. Still close to the frontier stage of development, with a heritage of violence from the antebellum struggles over Kansas, Missouri was a constant source of difficulty to the Lincoln administration. After General Samuel R. Curtis's major victory at Pea Ridge, Arkansas, on March 7th and 8th, 1862, organized Confederate military operations in the state ceased. But Southern troops continued to lurk along the border in Arkansas, encouraging and assisting numerous bands of bushwhackers and guerrillas. the most notable of which was the murderous band of William C. Quantrill. The depredations of these pro-Confederate groups were matched by the raids staged by Jayhawkers from Kansas, who sought revenge for the destruction wrought by the Missouri border ruffians during the Kansas imbroglio. As a result, civilian life and property was at risk throughout the state. The sparsely settled western counties became a war zone, and throughout the state there was security only in sight of federal troops or state militia. After Governor Claiborne F. Jackson fled Missouri in 1861, a state convention named Hamilton R. Gamble, a conservative former Whig, provisional governor, and he continued to hold this office until 1864. Gamble and General John M. Schofield, whom Lincoln appointed to succeed Halleck in Missouri, got along well enough, but after September 1862, when Curtis replaced Schofield, relations between the governor and the military deteriorated. Curtis began to listen to Missouri anti-slavery men who complained that Gamble was motivated only by hunkerism and a wish for political influence. Presently, the governor and the general were locked in controversy, and both appealed to the president for help. When the rival factions in Missouri presented clear-cut issues to the president, he had no hesitation in choosing his course, though he sometimes had difficulty in getting his subordinates to follow his orders. In December 1862, when federal troops arrested the Reverend Samuel B. McPheeters, pastor of the Pine Street Presbyterian Church in St. Louis, for unmistakable evidence of sympathy with the rebellion, Lincoln warned General Curtis that the U.S. government must not undertake to run the churches, and ordered him to let the churches as such take care of themselves. After an interview with the minister, the president was convinced that McPheeters was, at heart, a rebel sympathizer. But so long as he committed no overt act, Lincoln didn't want him punished, upon the suspicion of his secret sympathies. Then, having taken the high ground, he made the mistake of leaving the final decision to General Curtis. Hearing no further complaint, Lincoln supposed that his wishes had been carried out, only to learn, nearly a year later, that Curtis had prohibited McPheeters from preaching in his own church. Exasperated, the president repudiated the military order, making his position explicit. "I've never interfered, nor thought of interfering, as to who shall or shall not preach in any church. Nor have I knowingly or believingly tolerated anyone else to so interfere by my authority." More complicated Missouri issues, the president tried to decide on a case-by-case basis, giving a free hand neither to civilian authorities nor to the military. Pressed by Gamble to rule whether the new militia companies he was raising were going to be under the authority of the governor or the federal commander, Lincoln declined to give an opinion on the abstract merits of the question and demanded to know the consequences of whatever action he might take. "I think it's safer," he wrote Attorney General Bates with characteristic pragmatism, "when a practical question arises, to decide that question directly, and not indirectly by deciding a general abstraction supposed to include it, and also including a great deal more." As the war progressed, Unionists in Missouri divided into bitterly hostile factions called the Charcoals, so called because of their concern for blacks and abolition, and the Claybanks, named because their principles were thought to be a pallid gray. And both camps demanded presidential support. Lincoln found it hard to choose between them. Temperamentally, he felt closer to the claybanks, or conservatives, many of whom were, like himself, former Whigs who had been moderate on the slavery question. Gamble and his fellow conservatives had loyally stood by the Union in the secession crisis. The president said later that they'd done their whole duty in the war faithfully and promptly, and when they disagreed with the president's actions, had been silent and kept about the good work. At the same time, he realized that when it came time to cast about for votes, the conservatives were tempted to affiliate with those whose record isn't clear. The charcoals, or radicals, on the other hand, were ideologues, whose dogmatic support of abolition and assumption of moral superiority Lincoln found hard to endure. But he recognized that the radicals were absolutely uncorrosive by the virus of secession. Personally hostile to the president, they were the unhandiest devils in the world to deal with, though he admitted that, after all, their faces are set Zionwards. He refused to back either faction. When the radicals charged him with favoring their opponents in a controversy over patronage in St. Louis, Lincoln replied firmly, "I've stoutly tried to keep out of the quarrel, and so mean to do." But it grew harder and harder to maintain his balance. By May 1863, he was writing with a real note of exasperation, "It's very painful to me that you in Missouri can't or will not settle your factional quarrel among yourselves. I've been tormented with it beyond endurance for months by both sides. Neither side pays the least respect to my appeals to your reason." By the end of the month, he decided to end this pestilential factional quarrel by removing Curtis, who'd been charged with being too friendly with the radicals, and reinstating Schofield, who was thought to be more broadly acceptable. He offered the new commander a simple test for success. "If both factions, or neither, shall abuse you, you'll probably be about right. Beware of being assailed by one and praised by the other." By that test, Lincoln himself was an enormous success. The conservatives considered him a prisoner of the charcoals. The radicals were convinced that the president was supporting Governor Gamble's plot to restore the slave power with the aid of Schofield, whose odor in the public nostrils, they said, was less fragrant than that of a polecat. Both factions began to attack Lincoln. The awkwardness of the president's position became clear in the summer of 1863, when Missourians were debating plans for the gradual emancipation of the slaves, a topic that had long been dear to Lincoln's heart. "You and I must die," he told a congressman, "but it'll be enough for us to have done in our lives if we make Missouri free." Aware that emancipation sentiment in a slave state had to be carefully nurtured, he repeatedly warned against those who urged radical steps. A state like Missouri that tolerated slavery, he suggested, was like a man who had an excrescence on the back of his neck, the removal of which in one operation would result in the death of the patient, while tinkering it off by degrees would preserve life. He let it be known that the Union men in Missouri who were in favor of gradual emancipation represented his views better than those who are in favor of immediate emancipation. but he refused to endorse the conservatives' plan, which would not end slavery in Missouri until 1870, and provided for peonage ranging from 11 years to life. This scheme Lincoln found faulty in postponing the benefits of freedom to the slave, instead of giving him an immediate vested interest therein. Angered by the president's neutrality, Governor Gamble came to Washington in a vain effort to win his support for the conservative plan, but he got nowhere. Leaving, he attacked Lincoln as a mere intriguing, pettifogging, piddling politician. Lincoln's position equally infuriated the radicals. In September, they organized a delegation, headed by Charles D. Drake, to go to Washington and demand the removal of Schofield. They intended to present their demands to the president in the strongest possible terms, giving him, as one said, the choice whether he would ride in their wagon or not. Exasperated by a problem that was taking up too much of his time and attention, and angered by radical attacks on General Schofield, against whom no charge of dishonesty or incompetence had ever been raised, Lincoln gave the Missourians a frosty reception when they came to the White House on September 30th. He rejected their demands that he remove Schofield, put the entire state back under martial law, decree immediate emancipation, and authorize the recruitment of Missouri blacks into the army. Informing the radicals that he understood the causes of the chaos in Missouri as well as they did, he observed that in time of war, blood grows hot and blood is spilled. Confidence dies and universal suspicion reigns. Each man feels an impulse to kill his neighbor, lest he be first killed by him. Revenge and retaliation follow. But this is not all. Every foul bird comes abroad and every dirty reptile rises up. These add crime to confusion. The circumstances required harsh measures to preserve order, and General Schofield had effectively carried those measures out. Bristling, he bluntly declined to remove Schofield and stoutly announced, "I shall do what seems to be my duty. It's my duty to hear all, but at last I must judge what to do and what to forbear." The radicals went home his permanent enemies. Lincoln no longer believed that he could solve the Missouri question to anyone's satisfaction, including his own. He had, he told Attorney General Bates, no friends in Missouri. The whole issue reminded him of a lesson he'd learned as a boy when he was plowing. When he came across stumps too deep and too tough to be torn up, and too wet to burn, he said. He plowed round them. Never at his best when dealing with factions within his own party, Lincoln welcomed opportunities to rally behind him all of the Republicans, as well as those Democrats who endorsed his war policies. The approach of the fall elections gave him the opportunity to show that he was still a master politician. The 1863 elections were crucial for Lincoln and his party. At stake were important local offices throughout the North, and especially governorships in Maine, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Kentucky, and Iowa. If the strong Democratic resurgence manifest in the fall elections of 1862 continued, Republican chances of winning the next presidential election would be in peril. "All the instant questions will be settled by the coming elections," reported a White House intimate. If they go for the democracy, then Mr. Lincoln will not wind up the war, and a new feeling and spirit will inspire the South. Lincoln watched all these races closely, monitoring frequent reports from Republican workers in the field. Convention prohibited him from taking an active part in most of the canvasses, but with or without the president's explicit approval, his aides did whatever was necessary to ensure the defeat of the Democrats. In Kentucky, General Burnside proclaimed martial law and the imprisonment of Democratic candidates, and voters helped secure the election of Governor Thomas E. Bramlett, a Union Democrat favored by the Lincoln administration. In Pennsylvania, Republican Governor Curtin was in a close battle for re-election against Pennsylvania Chief Justice George W. Woodward, whose court held preliminary hearings on the constitutionality of the Conscription Act in September. Secretary Chase rallied banker Jay Cook and all the others who'd benefited from the financial policies of the administration by warning, "Governor Curtin's re-election or defeat is now the success or defeat of the administration of President Lincoln." To strengthen the Republican vote, the president acceded to Curtin's request and authorized a 15-day leave so that government clerks from Pennsylvania could go home to vote. And Secretary of War Stanton permitted commanders to furlough Pennsylvania troops who could be counted on to vote Republican. Ohio was a source of special worry to the president, for the Democrats had nominated Vallandigham for governor. The president found it hard to believe that one genuine American would, or could be induced to, vote for such a man as Vallandigham. Yet he recognized that his opponents saw this election as a means to repudiate his administration. Consequently, he watched the Ohio election, he told Gideon Welles, with more anxiety than he had in 1860 when he was chosen. And he encouraged his friends and the members of his administration to work for the election of the Republican candidate, John Brough. In Ohio, as in Pennsylvania, government clerks and soldiers were furloughed so that they could go home to vote. Secretary Chase stumped his home state for Brough, and Governor Yates of Illinois and Governor Morton of Indiana also campaigned for him. Illinois was also critical. And, as Lincoln's home state, it offered the one contest in which propriety permitted the president to participate. Republicans thought his presence was badly needed because Union victories at Gettysburg and Vicksburg had the paradoxical effect of strengthening peace sentiment. Many voters believed that with the Confederacy on its last legs, it was time to end the fighting and negotiate peace. On June 17th, even before those victories, the anti-war forces held a huge rally in Springfield, presided over by Senator William A. Richardson, the Democrat elected to succeed Browning. After listening to angry anti-administration oratory, the mass meeting demanded the restoration of the Union as it was, and voted against further offensive prosecution of this war. Lincoln believed such resolutions, which were echoed by other anti-administration gatherings all over the North, rested on fundamentally wrong-headed assumptions. A call for the restoration of the Union as it was meant abandonment of the Emancipation Proclamation and all other measures against slavery. It also meant an end to the recruitment of blacks into the Union armies, just at the time when Negro soldiers were proving their valor at Port Hudson on the Mississippi and in Charleston Harbor, where black troops of the 54th Massachusetts Colored Infantry, under Robert Gould Shaw, made a heroic but unsuccessful assault on Battery Wagner. Equally misguided, in the president's judgment, was talk of negotiated peace. Gettysburg and Vicksburg indicated that Confederate power was at last beginning to disintegrate, and, as he told John Hay, he anticipated that they'll break to pieces if we only stand firm now. He was convinced that the Confederate Army controlled the South. It was Jefferson Davis's only hope, not only against us, but against his own people. Without that military control, the Southern people would be ready to swing back to their old bearings. Until the Confederate Army was ready to sue for peace, there could be no meaningful negotiation. For this reason, Lincoln refused to receive Confederate Vice President Alexander H. Stephens, who asked permission to come to Washington under a flag of truce, ostensibly in order to facilitate exchange of prisoners. Curbing his personal wish to go to Fort Monroe for an informal chat with Stephens, the president allowed his cabinet to persuade him not to have any official communication with the Davis government. Even the appearance of peace negotiations would strengthen the enemy. Eager to put his views before the public, Lincoln welcomed an invitation from James C. Conkling to attend a huge rally in favor of law and order and constitutional government at Springfield on September 3rd. Doubtless he was tempted by Conkling's promise that not only would the thousands who will be there be prepared to receive you with the warmest enthusiasm, but the whole country would be eager to extend to you its congratulations on the way. Conkling reminded him that party activity in Illinois was already spirited, and noted, "The presidential campaign for your successor, if any, has already commenced in Illinois." The president really wanted to go back to Springfield, but he wasn't able to get away from his duties in Washington because Rosecrans had finally begun his long-awaited campaign to maneuver the Confederates out of Chattanooga. Tied to his desk, Lincoln sent Conkling a carefully composed letter to be read to the assembly. "Read it very slowly," he urged. He wanted his views to be heard and understood. The letter was a hard-hitting defense of his administration's policies. Though it began with a tribute to all those who maintain unconditional devotion to the Union, it was a frankly partisan message. He dismissed as deceptive and groundless charges that he was preventing peace through compromise. Suppressing any notice of Alexander Stephens's aborted mission, he assured his listeners that he had no word or intimation in relation to any peace compromise from the rebels. He then turned to a defense of his Emancipation Proclamation, which his opponents condemned as unconstitutional. "I think differently," he stoutly replied. "I think the Constitution invests its commander-in-chief with the law of war, in time of war. And according to the laws of war, property, including slaves, could be taken when needed. As a military measure, he'd offered the slaves freedom, and he firmly insisted, 'The promise being made must be kept.' To opponents who said they wouldn't fight to free Negroes, he replied, 'Fight you then exclusively to save the Union.' But when peace did come," he predicted, There'll be some black men who can remember that, with silent tongue and clenched teeth and steady eye and well-poised bayonet, they have helped mankind onto this great consummation. While I fear there'll be some white ones unable to forget that, with malignant heart and deceitful speech, they have strove to hinder it. The signs look better, he wrote, because Western armies had captured Vicksburg. The Father of Waters again goes unvexed to the sea. Thanks to the great Northwest for it. Thanks, too, went to the sons of New England, New York, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, hewing their way right and left. And he didn't forget the Union soldiers from the sunny South, in more colors than one. Nor did he ignore what he called, in an inappropriate attempt at cuteness, Uncle Sam's web feet, which had made their tracks on the bays, rivers, bayous, and wherever the ground was a little damp. Thanks to all, he cheered, for the great republic, for the principle it lives by and keeps alive for man's vast future. Thanks to all.
This ends Disc 25.